hoping that you stay healthy.
Hi, everybody. It's Beatty Condranos, host of the Ask Beatty Show. Audio Now, the Progressive Radio Network now has an app. All you have to do is go to the App Store on your cell phone and search the Progressive Radio Network. You can listen live to PRN shows and also listen to past.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, truths about Syria and behind the scenes with Edward Snowden. We're going to be having three video clips tonight and then opening it up for your feedback, and which we rarely, if almost never do, but I thought you would have some interesting insights you'd like to share. We're going to take a look at a senator from Virginia exposing the Syrians' weapons of mass destruction false flag. This person also is very concerned about what Hillary Clinton ordered based upon WikiLeaks emails that caused the death of Chris Stevens and the others. Now, go back if you listened to this program for about 4 or 5 years. And at that time, I had information from qualified sources that the reason that the terrorists went after the Benghazi embassy was an annex was because weapons confiscated from Gaddafi after his defeat were being shipped to terrorist groups that were supported by the United Nations, Saudi Arabia, and Great Britain directly into Syria and also into Turkey and then sent in Syria. Well, that would be in violation of international laws. So both the State Department had to deny it, which they did. The intelligence agency had to deny it. Now you hear the truth about that. Also, it's rare that we hear from Edward Snowden. But in this case, you need to hear what he has to say about the elites in our society behind the scenes in so many of these episodes that we seem to be getting only partial information on. And he drops some major insights. Then we're going to start our show. Then we're going to take a listen in on brand new information. And this brand new information comes from famed war reporter Robert Fisk. Now, Robert Fisk, if you're not familiar with him, he is a heavyweight. In fact, he is arguably the most respected war correspondent in the Middle East, so speaks Arabic, of any reporter. And he is recognized as such. He's honest, objective, he's minded. But he doesn't buy into the false flags easily. And he was one of those people who agreed that Syria was going after its enemies and its own citizens with chemical attacks. All the previous attacks in Syria have been disproven to have come from Assad. Well, Robert Fisk, according to Tyler Durham, went there. Now, as far as I know, this little clip I'm going to play in a moment has not been aired. But he works for The Independent, one of the United Kingdom's quality publications. And the information he shares runs absolutely counter to nearly every claim circulating in major international press concerning what happened just over a week ago in the embattled suburb outside of Damascus. Not only has the veteran British journalist found no evidence, I repeat, no evidence of a mass chemical attack, but he's encountered multiple local eyewitnesses who experienced the chaos of that night, but who say the gas attack never happened. This is the first Western journal to reach and report from the site of the alleged chemical weapons attack, widely blamed on Assad's forces. And from there, in eastern Ghouta, Fish has interviewed a Syrian doctor who works at the hospital, shown in one of the well-known videos which works to depict victims of a chemical attack. Now, this is it. This is something that we in the United States, through the New York Times and CNN, through the White House and the Pentagon, none of these sources were on the ground. None of them had independent information that Assad had gassed his own people. But we were told that legitimized over 100 missiles going into Syria. Now, what's important is this. It's importantly that the report published last night is causing a stir among mainstream journalists who, minutes after the Saudi-sponsored jihadist group Army of Islam accused the Syrian army of gassing civilians, began uncritically promoting the Assad gassed his own people narrative as an already cemented and proven fact based on the mere word of a notoriously brutal armed group who itself has admitted to using chemical weapons on the Syrian battlefield in prior years. Also notable is that no journalist, no international observer was anywhere near the town when the purported chemical attack took place. So controversy ensued immediately after Fisk's report, especially as he is among the most recognizable names in the past 40 years of Middle East war reporting, having twice won the British Press Awards Journalist of the Year prize, and is a seven-time the British Press Foreign Correspondent of the Year. Even the New York Times refers to him as probably the most famous foreign correspondent in Britain, and The Guardian called him one of the most famous journalists in the world. Again, he speaks Arabic, and he became famous for being among the few reporters in history to conduct face-to-face interviews with Osama bin Laden, which he did on three occasions between 1993 and 1997. Now, so let me just give you the overview of what is reported. This says that he was able to walk around and investigate newly liberated Duma without Syrian government or Russian miles, meaning no one was with him. He was alone. And, quote, "This is the story of a town, ravaged, stinking place of smashed apartment blocks and an underground clinic whose images of suffering allowed three of the Western world's most powerful nations to bomb Syria last week. There's even a friendly doctor in a green coat who, when I tracked him down, in the very same clinic, cheerfully tells me that the gas video, which horrified the world, despite all the doubters, is perfectly genuine." Wait. War stories, however, have a habit of growing darker. The same 58-year-old senior Syrian doctor then adds something profoundly uncomfortable. The patients, he said, were overcome not by gas. I repeat, not by gas, but by oxygen starvation in the rubbish-filled tunnels and basements in which they lived on a night of wind and heavy shelling that stirred up a dust storm. So, that's important. And Fisk goes on to identify the doctor by name, a Dr. Asim Rabahani, which is notable given the fact that all early reporting from the town typically relied upon unnamed doctors and anonymous opposition sources for the claims of a chlorine gas attack, lately morphed into unverified mixed chlorine and sarin gas. None of that is true. The doctor's testimony is consistent with that of the well-known Syrian opposition group, Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which initially reported, based on its own pro-rebel sourcing, that heavy government bombardment in the town resulted in the collapse of homes and underground shelters, causing civilians in hiding to escape. According to the source, which has long been a key go-to source for mainstream media over the course of the war, 70 of the men, women, and children have suffered suffocation as a result of the demolition of home basements over them due to the heavy and intense shelling. Keep in mind that that shelling was coming from rebels. So, to Fisk, I'm going to hear him say this, but it's a poor audio tape, so please listen carefully. It's not a good tape. We couldn't enhance it more than it is. The first reporter, legitimate reporter on the scene says, no gas attack. That means no chlorine gas, no sarin gas. This was dust with people living in tunnels, and it was suffocating them, and they went to the hospital, and the doctors there tried to help them. And so the rebels took advantage of that, and the Americans or the CIA then doubled down with England and France, and they went in and bombed. That is what now let's hear from Robert Fisk, a minute and 25 seconds on the ground, saying there is, the video is real, but they are not suffering from gas poisoning.
Being in the town of Douma, I found the clinic where the film of the children dropping at the mouth and having water thrown at them was made. But the senior hospital doctor, who actually spoke very good English, who was there, told me that the video is real, that they were not suffering from gas poisoning, but suffering from panic and hypoxia, because the amount of dust in the tunnels in which they live. All through the years, people in the Douma area have been living beneath their own homes in tunnels and basements. And that night, there was a lot of shelling by the Syrian army and by the Russian Air Force. And it produced a huge amount of dust and debris in the streets. And many people were finding it difficult to breathe. And when they reached the clinic, according to the doctor, someone shouted gas, and they panicked. But he did confirm that the film, the videotape, was indeed taken in the clinic there, the same clinic that I actually interviewed him in.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast.
Okay. So let's just review quickly before we go to our next segment here. You've just heard from the first legitimate report that there was no gas, chlorine or sarin. This was due to shells in the area, and there was a dust storm. And the dust storm, exacerbated by the people being underground and in tunnels, young people especially were being hit by dust so they couldn't breathe. That is a completely different narrative than what the American world public has been told. And if I can bring you this information, and just did, and it's reliable and accurate, which it is, then how is it that every one of our 17 intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, the National Security Agency, and Homeland Security, could not, with all of its hundreds of thousands of employees and experts, find the truth, or truth the Pentagon, Defense Department, and the President was looking for? So we have been lied to. We have been manipulated. And now when the expert teams go in there, they'll verify that. That means that we just aimed down some heavy missiles and brought us close to the brink to a possible confrontation with Russia that was completely unnecessary. Now we're going to hear from a senator who is exposing the Syrian weapon of mass destruction false flag narrative. Let's listen in.
From Virginia, like Congressman Tulsi Gabbard, he's also been to Syria and has spoken personally with President Bashar al-Assad. And also, like Congressman Gabbard, he believes that Syrian rebels are responsible for the recent chemical weapons attack in Syria. Now, Senator, while you and I are talking, I'm going to be showing my viewers some video of al-Nusra terrorists mixing, testing, and deploying chemical weapons. But that's not really a surprise to you, is it?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. You know, it was very widely reported there's a major CNN report that's easy to come up with online, and it talks about a major U.S. airstrike using B-52 bombers against an ISIS poison gas factory in Mosul. Now, of course, you don't just produce the gas and keep it in tanks. what you do is you put it in artillery shells and anti-tank mines and things of that sort. And so we know for a fact that they have gas. Back in 2013, the Defense Intelligence Agency, just before the Damascus gas attack, reported that Al-Qaeda had a major sarin gas capability. And so it goes way back, and the problem is that we have a CIA and a State Department that are, you know, they have objectives in mind, and they just put out whatever propaganda they can, and it's a huge amount because they've got an unlimited budget, and you know, it's just ordinary citizens who are able to use, you know, social media and that sort of thing to try to get the truth out. But you know, yesterday the White House felt compelled to come out and address my comments, and they put Sebastian Gorka on, and he just sort of went all around. He never did get to the basic issue of what would be the motive for Syria to use poison gas, knowing they'd enrage the world, and if they were going to use poison gas, why wouldn't they use it against a military target instead of just a gaggle of civilians walking down the street? So, I'm not at all surprised that you've got clear evidence of them doing this. There's been lots of evidence of it, and I think our reaction guarantees that there will be another sarin gas release, and it'll be blamed again on Syria. There's nothing Syria can do because the media is, they've got their stories already printed, pinning it on Syria, and the terrorists are just gleeful about this. It's like they can make us do whatever they want. The only reason they can is because the media is complicit in it.
That and the fact that they were trained by the CIA. Did you know that there are CIA funded rebels that are fighting Pentagon funded rebels in Syria?
Oh, we have a diplomatic mission. When we close down the Syrian embassy, we did that just before Syria conducted its presidential elections because we didn't want to have a serious black eye by having Syrian Americans vote overwhelmingly for President Assad. And we replaced the Syrian embassy with a diplomatic mission. And it's called something like the Syrian Revolutionary Armed Front or whatever. But basically, it is a mission whose diplomatic purpose is to lobby Congress for weapons to be used by ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all the other terrorist organizations over there.
Would this footage that I have be useful to you? You've got a much larger voice and a much larger reach than I do, and I'm desperately trying to prevent an unnecessary war with Russia, especially when it's based on faulty or misleading intelligence.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, we're starting to blame Russia for the sarin gas attack. I just ran across a couple of things. And, I mean, the absurdity, it doesn't matter how absurd the claim is, as long as all the media are in lockstep and say what they're told to say. They could say that, we've just discovered that men from the backside of the moon have invaded the planet. And if every news station published it as a fact, everybody on the street would agree. They'd say, yeah, boy, those men from the moon have just, they're all over the place. I mean, everybody says so. All the experts tell us it's true. But I'd encourage you to, you know, use your, you know, your network of emails or however you communicate and get the word out about this. The key thing and the one thing that has the other side stumped is that they cannot articulate a motive why Syria, which is winning on every front, would suddenly deliberately incur the wrath of the world by using sarin gas in a small attack and use it against civilians instead of the armored formations and the massive defensive fortifications of the terrorists. There's no rational reason for it. And then I had one guy say, oh, well, isn't he a tyrant and don't tyrants do crazy things? Well, I mean, that's just a stupid answer. If you look at the many videos of President Assad, he is exactly the way he was when I met with him in his office. He is a soft-spoken, very thoughtful, extremely intelligent, rather gentle man. And his wife is very much the same. She's a little more charismatic. But in 6 years of war, we have not been able to come up with one puppet leader who's popular with the Syrian people. The Syrian, you know, often the media says, oh, well, look at this. He, you know, Assad only controls so much of the country. Well, the fact is, I've been in Syria and I've driven out in ISIS-held territory. And the vast bulk of Syria is rocky desert. It's not sand dunes, but it's rock. And it's basically uninhabited. There may be one family per square mile in some areas. But when you talk about the inhabited portions, 80% of the Syrian people are under government control and protection. And of the other 20%, the ones that are under the terrorist rule, two-thirds of those wish that they could get over to the government side, and they just can't.
Well, you know, Senator, whether Assad launched that strike or not, he's been vilified by the entire world, which actually I think was the very purpose of this false flag. And at some point, he's going to have to go. But for the time being, don't you think that defeating ISIS should be the first order of business? You know, if the U.S., Russia, and Assad coordinated their efforts, ISIS would be toast in very short order.
Well, I don't think President Assad is the problem. Here's the thing. He is essentially the glue that holds Syria together. The reason that from the very beginning they have tried to get him out of office is because they know that he has the love and affection of the Syrian people. The only people who say Assad must go are foreigners. They're not Syrians. Now you've got some of the jihadists, the beheaders and the crucifiers and the people that rape six-year-old girls, and they say Assad has to go. But when you talk about the man in the street, the ordinary, everyday Syrian, they love President Assad and his wife, and I think they generally understand that if he goes, he's going to be replaced by a puppet regime installed probably by Saudi Arabia. It'll be a vicious Islamic state under Sharia law, and they're going to start executing hundreds of thousands of Christians and Alawites who are known as the friends of the Christians. They want to get rid of him because they want to install Al-Qaeda.
Well, you know, that's been my position for years, that this whole Arab Spring was nothing but a plan by the globalists to surround Israel with hostile Islamist regimes headed by the Muslim Brotherhood, which we know is the political counterpart to Al-Qaeda.
You're right on track. And this idea that somehow you would be amazed. I went to visit Assad, and it was easier for me to go in and visit with him than it was for me to go through the airport or probably even to go into the county library.
Do you have any plans to go back to Syria in the near future? Because I'd love to tag along.
I'm almost sure that I will. Unless we install a jihadist government.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I feel safer there than I would if I went to Saudi Arabia or Turkey, because I think I'd be assassinated if
right.
I went to one of those countries. But, you know, it is amazing. Do you know Bashar al-Assad drives himself? His wife walks her children to a public school there. When they took over, when he became the president, people were quite startled because instead of moving into some presidential residence, they rented an apartment. And everybody, I know a doctor who was living there, and he said, "Gosh, the chatter everywhere was, do you know who just moved in? The guy three doors down is the president of Syria. They just live like ordinary people. They're not ostentatious. The Asma Assad, who was raised in England." She has Syrian heritage. She doesn't wear any jewelry, nothing. She's extremely charismatic, and it's hard to explain. She just something about her, her personality is just, she has such tremendous, both of them are enormously intelligent, and they're, you know, they're both totally devoted to Syria. And I'm sure, you know, when we put out the word that so-and-so must go, that's a death sentence. And either you jump on a plane and leave, or we kill you, we kill your wife, we kill your brothers, your sons, your children. This is just the way we do things. That's the way the CIA and the State Department have operated.
Now, would you blame that on the Obama-Clinton State Department, or is this more of a deep state thing where the globalist agenda is going to be pushed forward regardless of who's in charge of the State Department and the executive branch?
I guess there are two answers. I would attribute it to the deep state, which goes on, you know, generation after generation.
Right.
But I think it has become far more deadly and dangerous during the time. First, starting with George Bush, Dick Cheney, and then with Hillary Clinton. She sort of put it on overdrive. Obama put Muslim Brotherhood operatives all through the intelligence network and the national security network. So it's totally compromised at this point, has, you know, virtually no loyalty to the United States. Their loyalty is to the global, you know, billionaires of the world who, you know.
You mean like George Soros?
Yes, Soros and. There are probably, you know, somewhere around 100 guys who basically control the wealth of the world and they direct things. But you know, I can think. You know, when I was a little boy in elementary school, I was attending school in Coral Gables, Florida. Even then, we would talk about the Spanish-American War and how, when the battleship Maine was sunk, that was not the Spaniards who did it. It was a false flag attack, and it was an excuse for us to overthrow the Spanish Empire and occupy the Philippines and Cuba, and frankly, I think no good came of any of it for us, but it's been going on. I mean, the purpose of one, well, I mean, they have many purposes, but one purpose of the CIA and State Department, which really are integral, but one is part of the other, and one of their purposes is to create pretext for war. Wars don't just suddenly break out because, you know, some incident occurs. They're planned. You can go on the internet quite easily, and if you look up, if you Google General Wesley Clark.
Right. You know, actually, I just happen to have that video handy. So give me just a second here. And, why don't we all take a look at this real quick. And this is General Wesley Clark describing a Pentagon plan to invade 7 countries in 5 years.
I went downstairs. I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. He said, I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. He said, but I guess they don't know what to do about terrorism. And so they think, but they can attack states, and they want to look strong. And so I guess they think if they take down a state, it will intimidate the terrorists. And, you know, it's like that old saying, he said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem has to be a nail. Well, I walked out of there pretty upset, and then we attacked Afghanistan. I was pretty happy about that. We should have. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office. It says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in 7 countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. I said, 7 countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it.
You know, the one thing that all of those countries had in common was the fact that none of them had a central bank.
Yes, well, the bank people, if you look, now Libya, there were 2 reasons for invading Libya. One is that Libya had just established a hard African currency backed by gold.
The dinar, yes.
Yes, and you know, this was a tremendous threat to the Western world because we're bankrupt. We just simply print money that has no meaning, and it works so long as there is not an alternative to go to, and the very genuine and legitimate concern of the banking elite was that if people began to compare and say, okay, with this currency you can exchange for gold. This currency you can use to light your cigars with or whatever you want, but you can't do anything else with it. People would say, you know what? I think I want to have hard currency. And so that, you know, Libya had to fall because of that. The other thing, though, is that we had to get into Libya – in order to plunder their weapons and use them to overthrow Syria.
Senator, you've basically just confirmed everything that I've reported about Libya and the Middle East for the last 4 years. In fact, I think that that's what got Ambassador Stevens killed, was that he was running guns and fighters from Libya to Syria through Turkey. And Fox News famously exposed this several years ago.
There's been a lot of discussion about what our operatives were doing there at the time when this attack happened, and that there was discussion about moving weapons out of that very volatile area in Libya. What do we learn about that in here, Catherine?
Well, Martha, another DIA memo dated October 5th, 2012, leaves no doubt that U.S. intelligence agencies were clearly aware that lethal weapons were being shipped to Syria via the port of Benghazi. In a recent interview with Brett Baer, the former acting CIA director skirted the topic.
Were CIA officers tracking the movement of weapons from Libya to Syria?
Can't talk about that.
Can't talk about it.
Can't talk about it.
You know, Senator, I'm fully convinced that Hillary Clinton was having Ambassador Stevens and the CIA run guns and personnel to Syria in furtherance of a criminal conspiracy to topple Arab leaders across the Middle East. What do you think about that, Senator? Was Ambassador Stevens running guns to jihadists?
Well, what happened? He had moved 20,000 anti-aircraft missiles into Libya during the uprising, which we staged. We, you know, the CIA created it, and then we were concerned. We wanted to recover them afterwards. And he held a meeting with I'm not sure what level he was, but he was a Turkish official. And he held the meeting at that residence where he was killed. He tried to buy back the missiles, and the Turks said, no deal. The Turks knew where they were. They didn't have them all in a warehouse, but they knew where all of them were located. And so they were sort of the central source for recovering them. And the Turks blew us off. And then I actually have a contact who knows the man who lived in the house across from there. And in order to... in order not to be killed himself or something, he went out and sort of accompanied the jihadists as they went in, and he was actually there. He saw Chris Stevens' body dragged out of the room, and interestingly, that particular place had an emergency escape route built into it. And it's one of these doors, you open it up, there's a slide, you slide down the slide into an armored car, and the armored car takes off and you escape. There were six Caucasian men who slid down there and escaped and left, you know, left Stevens in there. And now, normally, he would be the first to go, but the speculation is that he was deliberately killed on orders of Hillary because she just did not want to have fingerprints. And he had been her personal emissary to the revolution, so he knew where all the skeletons were buried. And,
right.
To simply have him gone, and he'd take to the grave all of the dirt that he'd been involved in. But listen, I've got to run. I thank you very much for what you're doing.
Bring it down.
Get the word out as much as you can.
Okay, now we heard a lot of statements there. This was done. This interview was done before the information I just gave you. The information I gave you early in the program is the most current, and it is that there was no sarin gas, no chemical gas, there was no reason, no justification whatsoever for this altercation and this posturing and this capacity to step over a line and antagonize Russia into a conflict would not have gone well for anyone. Now he talks about something that everyone I know who has information on Benghazi says the same thing. And also leaked WikiLeaks cases between the State Department, Hillary Clinton personally, show that Gaddafi had to go, and because of the gold denier. But here's what we also should understand about what was occurring at that time. Libya, of all the 54 countries in Africa, was the most prosperous. It had no debt. Its citizens had the longest lifespan, longer than an American's lifespan. It had the highest level of education, higher than American or British students. More people were literate, had gone to school in Libya as a percentage of the population than in the United States, as education was free. Women in Libya had more rights than any other country in the Middle East. In fact, they had the most rights of any Muslim group in the world. There was virtually no crime. He was diligent to keep terrorists out. Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda were in his prisons, over 600 of them, and the streets were safe. It was the Paris of Africa, and he had the largest amount of light crude oil, which is the most expensive and the most desirable of all oils. Libya was a friend. Libya had just recently completed one of the largest, if not the largest, irrigation project in world history, supplying fresh, clean water from their gigantic aquifer all throughout Africa where they did not have water. So he allowed all the farmers to prosper. If you wanted to be a farmer in Libya, Gaddafi would have a farm purchased for you. You were given a stipend when you were married of thousands of dollars. Gas was 17 cents a gallon. And every dollar that went in through the selling of oil, a part of that was distributed to every citizen in the country. They didn't have a single ruling power, as we have been led to believe, that he was this dictator who controlled the whole government. That wasn't true. In fact, he was even retired from active authority. He was working on his pet projects at the time this happened. And instead, they had thousands of little constitutional groups all over the country. So you were abiding by the rules established by your friends and neighbors and families in every area of the country. We don't have that here. And the rule of law was important. So just think of what we did. We destroyed a country that was not a threat to anyone. And look at it now. The largest amount of slave trading in the world is occurring in Libya with over, we've been told, a million people from other parts of Africa trying to get out of Africa and ending up in Libya and then being sold for slavery. We've seen the videos. And yet Clinton, who cackled about this, we came, we saw, he died. But look how he died. And also look at Sarkozy, the former president of France, who is now under indictment, being tried, because he did not disclose it. He received $63 million in cash from Gaddafi. And once again, there are now allegations that a French intelligence unit was on the ground leading the group who knew exactly where that his caravan, Gaddafi's caravan, trying to leave, was going. How did they know that? French intelligence. And they were there when he was murdered, after all. Why take him alive where he might just talk about all the people he has given money to and support? So nothing you've been told about Libya was accurate. It was as bad as weapons of mass destruction. And we're saying nothing you're told about Syria and Assad is true. Now listen to the other thing he said. He had no trouble going right into Assad's office. None. And that Assad drives himself to work each day. And his wife walks the kids to school each day. And they live not in any presidential palace. They live in an apartment building. And the apartment building is not protected by all kinds of security agents. He just lives like a normal neighbor right down the hall. That is the facade that we don't want to know, because if we know that this man's just a regular human being and loved by his people in Syria, then he couldn't be so easily demonized. But when you have such supplicant and obedient propagandists working for the New York Times and Washington Post and CNN and NPR, then you demonize him. But you don't go and talk with him. You don't interview him. You don't do your homework, just like they didn't do with Gaddafi. Now, we're going to open our lines, which we never do on our Progressive Commentary Hour. If you have input, if you have thoughts you'd like to share, our number is 888-874-4888. And we're going to, if I get those calls, I will come to you. I'm remaining. But otherwise, we're going to now hear about how the elites really control everything behind the scene. And who's saying this? Edward Snowden. So we're going to Edward Snowden interview now.
Protesting the Vietnam War. He was a very senior analyst for a corporation called RAND. He worked for the government in every way that matters. He was the kind of guy who would be briefing the Secretary of Defense. And he revealed a secret study, a top secret study, that said, look, the U.S. lied its way into the Vietnam War. And they continued to lie to perpetuate the war. They had basically thrown the monkey wrench in every peace deal intentionally because they were worried about the political consequences of it. And this was despite the fact that it was a war they can't win. But let's fast forward and leave sort of what we would consider the ancient history of whistleblowing and get into more modern things, right, the post-9/11 era. And it took this long because the Church Committee, which was, again, extremely adversarial to the intelligence agencies, it was not their friend, it was not their defender, it was not their cheerleader. Those held for about two or three decades. But then we got the September 11th attacks, and this intelligence community complex, right, all the spy agencies that had felt very sore for these 20 years, 20 plus years, had created a secret wish list of all of the changes to law that they would have wanted if they could have passed them, but they knew that they never would have passed with popular support in the United States because they violated the Fourth Amendment of our Constitution, which is the prohibition against not just the unreasonable searching of your home, your electronic communications, where people are listening to your phone calls, where they're breaking into your house, placing cameras, but the seizing of your personal things or your communications in the first place. You couldn't just pull things off the line without a warrant from a court. Well, this was sort of a secret plan that was sitting with the Department of Justice, had been negotiated with the intelligence agencies. When September 11th happened, it came off the shelf. They called it the Patriot Act. And in that moment of national crisis where everybody had been terrorized quite successfully, by an extraordinary attack. And in this moment of vulnerability, these agencies exploited that moment of national trauma to pass this. There was almost no dissent. There was, I think, a single dissenting vote in the House from an extraordinarily brave woman. But these things swept into power overnight. But there were individuals who were working in these agencies who saw this happening from the other side. And although the government publicly at the time we're saying, look, this isn't going to affect Americans. It's not going to affect your rights. It's not going to affect our allies. This is only about Al-Qaeda. This is only about terrorists. This is only about bad people, faraway people, the enemy. Don't worry about it. There's nothing to fear. Individuals like Thomas Drake, Bill Binney, Kirk Wiebe, Ed Loomis, these individuals were sitting at the NSA, and they went, well, if this is the case, why are we ordering huge amounts of electronic equipment and putting them inside the United States at telecommunications providers that aren't monitoring foreign communications, they're monitoring wholly domestic communications. And they went through proper channels. They went to the NSA's Inspector General. This is sort of an internal watchdog, right? It's supposed to be a relic of this 1978 era reform of the Church Committee. that says, look, when there's problems in classified areas, you go to this watchdog in the government, you tell them what's going on, and they'll fix it. They'll investigate. They'll find, are these activities unlawful? Are they unconstitutional? Are they contrary to the values of the nation? Are they waste, fraud, or abuse of the government's authorities? And when they did this, when they went internally, this one individual, particularly Thomas Drake, is the one the government came after the hardest. The NSA's number two lawyer, they've got about 100 lawyers. This guy was the number two. He talked to Thomas Drake personally. Thomas Drake said, look, I understand the mission. I understand we're in a moment of national crisis. But what you're doing is a violation of the Constitution, a fact which, by the way, was not affirmed by the courts in a meaningful way until more than 10 years later, past 2013. But the program was eventually amended because of the kind of things that he brought forward. In 2006, there were some amendments to the program as well. But the NSA's internal process, this watchdog that was supposed to be protecting the Constitution, that was supposed to be waiting for men like Thomas Drake to stand up and say, whoa, somebody's breaking the rules here. He responded like this.
If he came to me, someone who was not read into the program, and told me that we were running amok, essentially, and violating the Constitution, there's no doubt in my mind I would have told him, you know, go talk to your management. Don't bother me with this. I mean, you know, you did the minute he said, if he did say, you're using this to violate the Constitution, I mean, I probably would have stopped the conversation at that point, quite frankly. So, I mean, if that's what he said, then anything after that I probably wasn't listening to anyway.
This new wave of whistleblowers, the Thomas Drakes, the Bill Binneys, the Kirk Wiebes, the Ed Loomises, even the John Kiriakous, the Chelsea Mannings, if it had not been for them and their examples, I might have replicated their mistakes. Thomas Drake, for going through these proper channels, was hounded by the U.S. government. He was charged under the Espionage Act, the same laws they accused me of violating. This is a law that does not provide a fair trial. You are literally prohibited by law from presenting your defense to the jury. You can't tell them why you did what you did and have them decide if that was basically a relevant enough threat to the operation of the system that your acts made sense. The same way that in the United States, even a murderer can say, look, this person was threatening my life, and the jury can consider maybe this was self-defense, is denied to whistleblowers in the United States who reveal information to journalists. Under U.S. law, it doesn't matter. These men did it anyway. They did everything right. They even went to Congress. Going to journalists was an act of last resort. And for that, the U.S. government destroyed their lives. None of them continued in their career. Many of their pensions were threatened. Thomas Drake was charged with multiple felonies. Bill Binney was pulled out of the shower at gunpoint. Chelsea Manning is currently serving 35 years in prison in the United States. And I say if it had not been for these individuals, what I did, my own actions, and the public benefits that have derived from them would not have been possible.
We know. We know from the leaks that the NSA has a global surveillance program and is collecting massive amounts of private data. But I would like to touch on details that specifically relate to Germany. Can you talk about these leaks and how do they affect the public here?
Yeah, so I won't get into specific programs that haven't been described by journalists before, because I make sure the people who are doing the documents get a chance to check my biases. If I'm sort of speaking from the hip, there's a chance that I say something wrong, I make the wrong political calculus, and even though there's no guarantee of harm or even likelihood of harm, I have tried to act in absolutely the most responsible way, an overly responsible way, to establish that the government will respond the same, the government will retaliate the same, regardless of how careful the whistleblower is. Whether an individual in the United States goes to WikiLeaks or they publish these things directly, unredacted on the internet themselves,
or whether they work as I did, where you have a system of checks and balances where journalists have the material. They make the publication decisions, not myself. And then they even give the government a chance in advance of publication to review the stories and go, hey, maybe you guys don't understand the details here. Maybe you don't see the big picture here. Maybe there's one little sentence here that you don't quite get. We'll put a human life at risk here. And because of this, we'd like to share this evidence with you that that is in fact the case, and for you to consider whether or not you want to modify your story as a result. And that has been followed in every case in the reporting that has arisen from me. But despite that, the U.S. government makes no distinction whatsoever. And I think this is an important thing to establish because it means the government's not actually concerned with harm mitigation. They're not actually concerned with saving lives, with protecting programs, or ensuring that human sources or the efficacy of our security apparatus continues unimpeded. What they're looking for are easy arguments, things that sound persuasive at first glance, like saying, oh, this is going to endanger sources and methods. Oh, these journalists have blood on their hands. But when you look at cases, for example, the case of Chelsea Manning, again, she went to trial. The U.S. government was able to present their best evidence. They had control. It was a military court. They could hold secret proceedings for sections if they wanted to present classified information. And despite all of this, the government was asked by the judge to present evidence of any harm that came as a result. And again, remember, in the case of Chelsea Manning, these were things that were presented on WikiLeaks. They eventually made their way to the public in completely unredacted form. And these were classified documents, I think roughly 750,000, both military records and diplomatic records. And in court, in front of the judge, the U.S. government said, we can't demonstrate that anyone has been hurt, that anyone has died, and we aren't even going to try, because from our perspective, it doesn't matter. Now, if this...
Well, that was Edward Snowden giving us some very important insights. That's it for today's program. Just giving you the facts and giving you insights that the mainstream media refuses to share. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all very much for listening. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
What's up? Hey, man, what's your name?
What's
up? Woo! It's everything, it's everything.
Get down today.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die.